Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
Join me in welcoming our first storyteller to the stage, Ani Thomas.
Hi. So, I'm in the back of a truck, and I'm hitchhiking across another country, and there's maybe half a dozen other people in the back of the truck with me, but I'm the only foreigner. And I'm garnering lots of curious stares, but I don't mind too much because I like the curiosity. It inspires conversation. In the back of the truck, the walls are really tall, and so I can't see any of the countryside that's rolling past us. I've been back here for a couple of hours, but I've been in the country maybe a week or so, and I realize that all my time has been spent looking for food. Actually, not just food, but paper, like napkins, because nobody told me that there's no toilet paper in the country, so I'm not really prepared. I don't know what to do. It seems that napkins are just as scarce as toilet paper, though. Looking for food has been an adventure. I went to the grocery store, and it's nothing like going to the grocery store here. I had to wait in line for 45 minutes before I got in. And when I got inside this really small room, there's three or four people working there. And can you hear me okay? Three or four people working there. And I'm looking at the shelves, and there's absolutely nothing to sell. And I wonder, no one else is saying anything at all. I wonder if maybe I'm missing something, but I ask politely, are you expecting to get some more food in soon? Oh, yeah. When? We were expecting that 3 weeks ago. Well, I am a visitor here, so I don't want to be rude, and I don't say anything about the long line of people outside that would be saved time by telling them that there's no food to buy. Instead, I just quietly leave. I'm on the back of this truck now, though, and it's a little bit chilly for a tropical country. When we're traveling in the back of the truck, it's sort of cold. So I reach in my backpack and grab my jacket, and I see a little can of sardines that I had packed with me from back in the States. I pull it out. Great, perfect time for this treat. Sardines always remind me of when I lived in Portugal, and we would grill sardines out in the street and have some nice green wine with it. But right now, I eat the sardines very carefully, and I'm really careful not to spill any of it because I have no napkins. When I'm done eating the sardines, I put the can down a couple of feet away from my backpack so it doesn't spill on me. And right about now, the truck stops and we pick up another passenger. I can hear the ladder being put up against the dump truck, and a little lady comes over the wall, and there's a couple of blocks for her to step on when she gets down. A couple guys help her down with some packages, and next comes the goat. And there's a gentleman over here who's pretty upset about the goat. And he's very vocal. He's standing up and he's demanding that the goat go away. And I'll mention that I feel pretty confident in this language of the country that I'm in. But usually, I'm having a hard time understanding anyone in this country. And I imagine it's because they've been so isolated for the last several decades that they have their own pronunciations, their own vocabulary, their own colloquialisms, and I'm really struggling to understand anything that they say, but I understand this guy's upset about the goat. That's obvious. He loses the argument, and he sits down, and that's about when we take off. So we take off down the road, and about 5 minutes later, of course, the goat pees. And we all watch, because that's the only entertainment. As the pee follows the list of the truck directly over to the grumpy man over here, and he erupts in explicatives, stands up, and has to move all of his things. And we all laugh. Good entertainment. So about this time, I look over, and there's a woman maybe 7 or 8 feet away from me under a blanket. And I see that she has my can of sardines. She has it like this, and she is voraciously licking every drop of nutrition and flavor out of that can. And I am instantly ashamed and embarrassed. This is such a luxury, and here I am eating it in front of everyone, and I didn't even think to offer it to people. I'm horrified, and the picture of her eating like that, I've never seen a human being eat like that, has stuck with me 20 years. I had lots of adventures in this country. Oh, wow. But I'm not going to tell you all of them. I'll just skip over a little bit, but everything from being chased by a machete to sitting at a large table cleaning rice with women to visiting a village where they slaughtered a pig in my honor. I was a vegetarian. They slaughtered a pig and had a huge party. Everybody in the village came, 200 people dancing, and they made a big deal out of me, a backpacker, coming to visit. And they made me feel like a hero, though I was far from a hero. I can't tell you all of the stories, sleeping in farmhouses with dirt floors, pigs chasing me around the perimeter, but I'll skip to the end. 2 months after being in Cuba in the year 2001. After 2 months, I'm pretty tired. It's pretty difficult to be here. I've seemed to have picked up this cough that everybody in the whole country has. And to top it all off, my ego is hurt because of all the world travel that I've done, I've never been ripped off until now. There goes my cushion. I only brought $300 for 2 months in Cuba to make myself live outside my comfort zone, to make myself interact with the people. But now I can't even pay for my exit tax to leave the country. Damn. Long story short, I miss the bus stop to the airport. I miss my plane by moments. 12 hours later, I'm cold, hungry, sick, tired, defeated, and waiting for the next plane. They've promised me that they will not charge me any fines. And after everybody is loaded on the plane, I'm anxious to get on. They say, oh, it's your turn. You have to pay this fine. Damn, I have no money. You know that. I've been asking you for the last 12 hours. So luckily, a journalist ran up behind me. He slapped down a $20 bill, which felt like $1 million. He paid for me to get on the plane. I thought I'm home free. They're calling my name, Ani Thomas. This is the third call, only they're speaking in Spanish. We're closing the doors. I'm beelining for the door, and an official stops me, takes my passport, and says, I need to talk to you. I said, they're calling me. I need to get on the plane. He says, mm-mm. He takes his time asking me all kinds of questions, and while he's talking, he rips my passport, making it invalid. He said, this is invalid. And honestly, I think I was so upset that I don't remember what happened, but I got on that plane just before they shut the door, and it was a surreal scene. It's a sea of Nordic heads. Everybody's well-rested, tanned, jovial, full of lobster, which is illegal for Cubans to eat in their own country, by the way. And I think they have had such a drastically different experience of Cuba than I have. But I wouldn't trade the authenticity for anything. I get to my seat, and this lovely Swedish woman talks to me, and she says, "Honey, did you have a hard time getting on the plane?" And I try to smile at her, and instead I burst into tears, because this is the moment that I can let go. My story tonight is actually not about a Cuba travel log. It's about the concept of getting outside your comfort zone, because it's outside of our comfort zone where we challenge ourselves to become better people, stronger people. It's outside of our comfort zones where we challenge our thoughts and we learn about our neighbors. So I would feel fine if you drop me off in the middle of a foreign country. I feel fairly comfortable with that these days. But what really terrifies me and takes me outside of my comfort zone is being up here tonight. And for better or for worse, I accept the challenge. Thank you.
Bonnie Dillard was born in Augsburg, Germany. Please welcome my friend Bonnie.
Hello. I am so glad to be here. I've wanted to tell this story for 10 years. It's not my story. It's my son's story, Brian. He was a goofy guy. This was his kilt. He wore this to his first job interview. Isn't it cute? What do you think? It fits. Anyways, this story is Brian's. He was my youngest son. He was obsessed with whatever he chose to do. He loved music. He loved to dance. Swing dance, ballet, any kind of dance. He loved to sing. When he was in college, he was in operas, which is kind of surprising for a guy who loved rock and roll. He found his voice in college. He was passionate about singing. Each of these abilities amazed me as his mother because I can't do any of those things. However, Brian was stubborn. He was a difficult kid. He drove me nuts, to tell you the truth. He never did figure out how to handle his finances, ever. In college, he collected parking tickets. I went through his glove compartment. There were dozens of parking tickets. In high school, if you were a teacher in high school when he was there, he's the one who collected all the doorstops. We found a tote full of doorstops in the basement. His prize was the one to the welding shop. It was about 25 pounds. It was this big. He just got the biggest kick out of that. I don't know why. Anyways, he was a hoot. He loved music. He actually made a CD. He called it Exit Row Mutiny because he and his brothers used to have some kind of joke being in the exit row. I don't know what that was about. He did all the instruments, the singing. He wrote his songs. It was absolutely stunning to me. Of course, I'm a little biased. So I was really glad he did that because right after that, the bottom fell out. He was fishing in the summer and something weird started happening. He started having breakdowns. We couldn't figure out what was wrong. They diagnosed him as bipolar and put him on medicines and gave him counseling. And he kept going to school, but it was hard. So he moved over to Eugene, Oregon, and he got a lot of support from his grandparents and his dad. But my husband and I went down, and we visited one time in Portland with him. And I was walking behind him, and he was dragging his left foot, and I kept saying, "What is going on with you?" And he said, "Oh, it's just sciatica." And so he called a month later, and he said, "I'm dropping things. I can't figure out what's going on." And he hated that he kept dropping, especially his guitar picks. And I insisted he go to the doctor. He had brain cancer. And but, of course, he still has to break all the rules. And right before the biopsy, I went down to hang out with him and So we go to this waterfall, and we're climbing up these steep areas trying to get up to this waterfall, exactly what he was not supposed to be doing. And we jump into the water, and we go sliding down over the rocks. We had a blast. It was so much fun. It's one of my best memories. And then that night, his brothers and I took him to his favorite hot springs, just right out of Eugene. It was so beautiful. I've never seen so many stars. I'll never forget the conversations we had that night. But anyways, because of the physical location of the tumor, he lost the use of his hand, his left hand, and he had trouble walking and a lot of trouble with, you know, cancer treatments. So he ended up coming back to Kodiak, which was not in his plans. He did not want to give up school. But after this process of grieving and working through the anger, Brian and his family, all of us together, we ended up having this incredible relationship, something that I never thought could ever happen. He told me I was his best friend. I'll never forget that. Many amazing humans during that time came to our home. His doctor came. His dentist came, cleaned his teeth. A friend came and gave him acupuncture. Another friend came for massage and counseling. So many friends. Family came to visit. We watched Monty Python movies. We watched 6 Feet Under, laughed about death. Brian taught me about classical music, Arlo Guthrie, Tom Waits, and Modest Mouse. We made one-handed sushi. He kept trying to get me to like raw fish. And we put blueberries in everything, even kale. It was amazing. We added blueberries to everything. At this point, I want to share you, though, why I'm giving this talk tonight. Why have I waited 10 years? Well, one time when Brian and I were having one of our really deep conversations, he said, you know, there's only one thing I regret about my life, and it wasn't cancer. I regret wasting time. When I worry about the past and I have fears about the future, I'm missing out on the present moment. I spent so much time doing that, so much time running away from this moment. This moment is all we have. And in this moment, he was content. Those are his words. I wrote them down. I kept a journal during that time. I love the words to this Indigo Girls song, "No More Butterflies Coming Out of My Mouth." It reminds me that Brian taught me that living according to other people's expectations is a waste of time. His last 2 years at home were so incredibly intense, so brilliant, so sharply piercing in emotion that I can't remember much else from that time period. However, I remember being blown away by the constant, steady love and compassion of my husband, Jim, every single day. It feels like by sharing with me and the rest of our family his illness and finally his death, Brian provided a perspective that could not have happened any other way. Can this possibly be considered a blessing? This perspective that still slips through my fingers every day if I'm not mindful. Yes, it's a blessing. I am indeed blessed that I was allowed to be a witness. It was not for worse. It was part of life. We could not have kept Brian at home where he wanted to be if it wasn't for this community. And now we have a hospice organization for people who need help at the end of life or with any kind of illness. And I urge you to support our hospice. Thank you so much.
All Our next storyteller is Alex Woodside.
When I think of for better or for worse, I can't help but think of marriage and my husband. And when I think of my husband, I can't help but think about just how he's my favorite pain in the ass. But don't worry, it is a very mutual feeling. It goes both ways. And like any good marriage, our relationship is built on unconditional love, respect, kindness, and completely unrated, unfiltered sarcasm towards each other. In fact, 4 years ago in 2016, our first date went a little something like this. So we had been chatting online and finally got to the point where we were dying to meet with each other, and we did. And I'll never forget it. It was a beautiful, warm August day in San Diego, where we were both living there at the time. And I was so nervous. I had just gotten done eating dinner with my parents. I couldn't even swallow anything because I knew this was just such an epic moment for me. And finally meet Colin at a frozen yogurt shop that was one I'd actually worked at when I was in high school. And met him, and just from the beginning, just looked at him and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I still remember to this day, we still got the same flavored frozen yogurt. It was Irish mint. It was amazing. And then we both topped it off with, of course, cookie dough. It was epic. And then I wanted to take him somewhere. I've been born and raised here my whole life, and so he had never been to a place called Mount Helix. And it was basically a mountain, and it had a terrific view of San Diego, especially at sunset. So I drive up there, and there's some stones piled up on each other so you could sit and let your feet kind of dangle there and just sit and watch the beautiful sunset there. And we're just engaging in just the most beautiful conversation ever. I think we were there for at least 2.5 hours just talking with each other. And he starts sharing with me about the scar he had on his head, and starts sharing about how a few years before we had met, he had fallen from a horrific accident 50 feet onto a rock and sustained a severe traumatic brain injury. And I'm just thinking about this and keeping in mind, I'm a trained therapist. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, be empathetic, be understanding. But I also sort of mentioned this in the beginning. We were noting online, too, just how much we love sarcasm. So I've got that thought tucked in my back pocket. And he starts sharing just how horrific it was. And the treatment process was forever. It was at least a year going through those things. So when you have such a severe brain injury, it becomes, you know, so difficult to do some basic things. So he was sharing with me at one point, you know, couldn't, you know, be able to move his hands a certain way or concentrate very well, or, you know, be able to do some basic things like tying your shoes, you know. And so I'm looking down with our feet dangling there, and I take a shot at it, and I go, okay, I'm about to see if I either get this relationship or lose it in 2 seconds. And I looked down, and after he just said, you know, at one point I couldn't tie my shoes, and I looked down and said, and looked at his feet and go, is that why you chose to wear sandals tonight? And thank God he looked back and smiled and laughed. Ooh, I'm okay. That was a really big step. And he looked back and he's like, did you really just say that? We were busting up laughing. And I was like, I was either about to lose that relationship or gain one. And I clearly gained one, because not less than a year later, we found ourselves in Yosemite National Park, our favorite place in the world. And he was down on one knee and asked me to be his wife and best friend for life. And of course said yes, you can't say no to that. And so that's been the beginning of some of our journey. And about a year and a half later, we're continuing our beautiful rock climbing journeys and going all over the place. And we find ourselves in a place called Idyllwild, a little bit out of San Diego. We're doing our rock climbing, and we're all geared up to, you know, go camping, like be in a tent, be outside, all of that. And then we get cold We were such wimps trying to get through there, and we decided, you know what, let's go find a hotel, because it was starting to snow and wind coming in. We definitely have toughed it out hard. 30 degrees now feels great out here. So, but either way, we wimp out. We go down to the city of Hemet and go into a crappy little hotel. But you know, it was one of my favorite memories, because while we were in this crappy hotel just trying to get through the weather, we were watching the Winter Olympics, and we were playing one of our favorite card games called Speed, and of course, it's a very rapid game. And that pain in the ass kept winning and winning and winning and winning and winning. I just could not get a break. It was so infuriating, until at one point there's a little kitchenette in the hotel room, and you know, we had just gotten done using our Coleman stove and getting everything ready and prepared. And I was saying, after the last round he'd won, I was like, forget it, I'm over this, I'm going to go finish the dishes. And his retort back was, oh yeah, where you belong in the kitchen. And from there, a dish towel fight went out rapidly, just whipping it at each other. And I'm pretty sure I got him right on the butt, right on the aiming spot. So those have been some favorite memories. And then 2019, we moved up here. And then on September 19th of this past year, we received the best news. We were expecting our first baby. And we were so surprised, so thrilled. And 3 weeks in later, after we found out, we lost our baby. It's definitely one of the hardest moments. And a few months go by, we're healing and feeling more hopeful, to only have it happen again this week. Nothing will challenge your marriage more than losing a baby you never got to know. Losing a baby you never got the chance to hold. But I'll never forget this Valentine's, because while we may not have our babies, we have each other. And I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. Despite the challenges, we know God is still good and has our very best days ahead of us. We have hope. We have faith Jesus will deliver the promises he has for us. So, for better or for worse, in high tide or low tide, Colin, I'll be by your side. Thank you.
Lindsay Glynn came to Kodiak in August for a teaching gig at Kodiak High School about 12 years ago, 2007. James and Lindsay were married and are now here to share a story of some of the journeys since then.
Sorry, guys, I need a minute. So James was supposed to be up here with me, but for better or for worse, my story has a couple layers of that. And as you see, he's not. So for better or for worse, you've got me. Handful of years ago, my parents live in Anchorage, and handful of years ago, we were going to go over in the summer to hang out with my family, to see movies and stock up on school clothes and kind of do the big city stuff. And I'll tell you, my dad, my whole life, has been involved with the youth of our church, specifically the Boy Scouts. So often our family was the testers to see if he had a trip, what trip he had planned on, to figure out what would go wrong. So he had this idea of this trip he wanted to take, and sure enough, some things went wrong, but I won't, that's a little foreshadowing. The plan was that we would drive down south to Portage, catch a train about 30 minutes that would take us to Spencer Lake and Spencer Glacier. We had some pack rafts with us, and we were going to paddle across the lake, enjoy the glacier and the icebergs and things, and then hit Placer River, which would take us a couple hours float back to our cars. Fun afternoon. So let me tell you a little bit about the gear we planned to take. My family, my husband and our girls and I, our girls were about 7 and 5 at the time, we're going to be in the hoser boat. Hoser boat, so named from the cinematic masterpiece of Strange Brew, if you're familiar with it. It might be worth a watch this weekend. But The hoser boat was a 10-foot faded orange Achilles raft that had leaky seams, loose valves, and the floor was more patchwork than actual original Hypalon. But you guys, I loved this boat. My sister and I have spent so many summers just enjoying all the rivers of Alaska. In fact, we told each other, promised each other, that whoever got married first and had kids would get the blessing of bringing home their newborn babies into this holy, leaky, saggy-seamed boat. Anyways, we love this boat. So that was rolled up as tight as possible and strapped to a backpack frame. My dad's, for he and my mom, his plan was to borrow an inflatable kayak that his buddy used when he would moose hunt. My dad figured if his friend could pack a dead moose across a lake, why not his wife, who just recovered from hip surgery on a whitewater river? So we pack our gear up together. We drive south to Portage. We get on the train. The girls felt like they were on the Hogwarts Express. It was awesome. This was late summer, so we see a lot of, you know, kind of early fall colors along Turnagain Arm. The train ride was spectacular. We unload. This whistle stop was literally a platform in the middle of a woods that said lake, glacier, that way. So we get our stuff. We walk to the lake, hike out there, get the boats pumped up, and we're on our way. The lake was awesome. Again, just so being so close to these huge chunks of ice, the beautiful blues, the glacier in the background, the pre-fall colors. Eventually, my dad kind of waves us on to say, okay, let's start heading towards the river. We paddle across the lake, and immediately the pace of our trip changed. I, to be honest, I don't remember a lot of the details of this part of the story because I was kind of working on navigating the river and keeping James at ease. He didn't like the fact that everything he loved was in 10 feet of old, rickety, hardly seaworthy Hypalon. And the river, it wasn't too bad. It was maybe a class 2 plus, class 3. Not unnavigable, but, you know, you got to be heads up. So as soon as we put on the river, we could see this trestle bridge the train would cross off into the distance. And right as before we're crossing under this bridge, I hear my dad yell behind us, and I realize my mom had fallen out. When we started, my mom was a little heavier than she is currently, and she had her life vest on, and she was sitting on the bow of my dad's boat, kind of, you know, feet up, just barely looking over her life vest. So when they'd hit the first wave train, I think she made the first one, but the second one, she fell out. So, for better or for worse, many layers in this story. So, quickly, there wasn't a really good spot to eddy up. The current was pretty swift and the bank was steep. So, right on the other side of this trestle bridge, we quickly paddled to the gravel bar that happened to be there. James heaved our boat ashore. I hopped out and was the first to the water as my dad and mom were passing by. Now, usually I wear sandals when we go boating. You don't need to worry about what, you know, your feet are wet, whatever, they dry. But for some reason, I wore extra Tufts that day. And my dad's an experienced boater. He's done this his whole life. He's trained his kids to do this. He had turned the boat to a 45-degree angle to this gravel bar and was trying to paddle upstream to help slow down. Again, the current was pretty quick. And as I get to the side of the river, you know, this isn't my dad's first man-wife overboard experience. So I come up to the edge of the water, and I'm, you know, come on, Dad, a little further. You know, I can't quite reach you. Come on, come on. Now, in retrospect, I didn't understand how dire the situation was. Remember, this is a glacial river. My mom was quickly succumbing to the effects of cold water immersion. And as I'm coaxing him along, I can't quite get you, James rushes by, plows into the river, grabs hold of the boat. Because he's secured the boat, my dad's able to grab my mom. And James, you guys, he's so strong. He hauls my dad, my mom, the boat against the current. He hauls them to shore to this gravel bar. Phew, safe and sound. Nice job, Blue Eyes. Anyways, as we now realize, my mom needs to warm up. Again, I'll have to use my Spanish teacher voice and talk faster now. Okay, so we realize that my mom needs to warm up. This was supposed to be a day trip, so we just grabbed, my daughters and I were going along the gravel bar trying to find some driftwood to make a fire. So we're looking for a driftwood, and we hear another yell, and there's someone else floating down the river. We must have hit the jackpot here. We realized there was a group of four other people who had different levels of boating experience, and this gentleman had fallen out of his boat, and so I figured someone had grabbed a throw bag and was throwing him and towing him to shore. We're getting the fire going, getting everyone warmed up. Our new friend now has joined us on the gravel bar and is enjoying our fire. He kind of was sort of given up, but once he got warmed up, he was okay. It turns out of the four people in their party, he was in the river. Another guy was across the river with just a paddle. Another lady was in her boat, her kayak, no paddle. Her boyfriend was further down the river trying to reclaim gear. So... And in the meantime, a train had stopped on this bridge and was just kind of sitting there. I don't know. Oh, we had a big audience to our little spectacle here. But this train had stopped, and it was kind of waiting to see if it needed to take people back to town or back to if we needed some help. So after a quick paddle lesson of these four people, they get on their gear and they go on their way. My mom jumps into the hoser boat with us. Now my dad has a much lighter load and is able to navigate the river better. We portaged along the gravel bar, just kind of, there's some kind of splashy water there that we wanted to avoid, and went on our way. Everyone safe and sound, for better or for worse, we all made it out alive. Now there is, one more thing. So we were about 5 hours later than normal than we planned to be, and we were starving. So as soon as we got into Anchorage, we found the first Taco King we could, and my 5-year-old got some jalapeno in her eye. But other than that, we were all okay. So this is the part that James would like you to know. First of all, the hoser boat wasn't this lovely relic of my childhood. It was a 60-pound piece of garbage that we strapped to an old rickety, ill-fitting backpack frame that he had to haul about a mile and a half to the lake. Second of all, when he went in to grab my dad's boat with my mom, the water was up to his chest, and he was bouncing along. The current was so quick, it was taking him along, and he was pretty lucky that he was able to haul them into shore. Again, love that guy. Third of all, the second friend that we found floating down the river, there was no throw bag involved. James, again, got into the river and had to pull him out. And finally, the section that we portaged that was kind of a little splashy, it turned out as a submerged rail car that had boat-piercing pieces of steel just inches below the water. So fortunately, we all got out of that alive. Now... James and I have had lots of betters in our marriage and our time together. We've had a few worses, lots of more betters than worses, fortunately. But I'll tell you that experience for me was a better. We had a great adventure. We have a fun story to tell. Our kids appreciate, you know, the beauty and outdoor activities like whitewater rafting. James and my mom will probably tell you it was a worse. They won't ever get into a boat with my dad in the near future. Thank you.
Please welcome to the stage Austin Looney.
So I first moved to Kodiak late in 2018, and when I got here, I had two main things on my mind. First, I had to scout out that perfect spot to be deer hunting come August 1st, and second, I had to find a place to ask this beautiful woman in red to be my wife. It was in pursuit of one or maybe both of those things that I found myself one day in May. I woke up, and me and my good friend Jake, we'd been looking at this little blue lake on the map for some time, and today was the day we were going to check it out. So we hopped in the truck, drove out the road, parked the truck, started hiking. We meandered our way around the bay and started climbing up this little hill that led to the lake, just crested up over the top, and there's the lake below us. Beautiful lake, crystal blue water, wildflowers growing in from the side, beavers swimming across, fish jumping out. It was perfect. And I knew in that moment, this is not going to be my deer hunting spot that fall. It was, however, where I would ask Haley to be my wife. Fast forward a few months, and she has since come up and joined me here in Kodiak, and today's the day. It's the big day. So I woke up and said, hey, I got a big adventure planned for us. We're going to go backpacking, camp at this lake I've always wanted to go to. And what do you say? So she was up for it. We loaded up the backpacks, grabbed the sleeping bags, the tents, the wine, ran in the safe, grabbed the ring, throw it in, hit the trail, drive out that same road, park at the same spot. Early on in the journey here is where the first shortcut comes in. See, when Jake and I first went, we took this long meandering trail, just beautifully maintained. It was perfect. But now the tide was out. I said, hey, we could just cut across that tidal flat right there, save us probably a good hour of time. And she trusts me implicitly, so she said, yeah. We start trudging along across that empty tidal flat, and pretty good going at first. A lot of rocky soil, sand. Gets a little muddier, and a little muddier, and a little muddier, and pretty soon... we are post-holing up to our knees in the nastiest muck that Kodiak has to offer. But the sun is high in the sky. It's a beautiful day. Spirits are high. We pushed on. Get past the tidal flat, come to the base of that hill, and we see a young family coming down the trail. And I thought, well, weird. We're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Didn't expect to see anyone. But, hey, Maybe they can give us some good intel, see what it was like up there, you know, give us some information. They make their way down to us, and I said, how's the lake? How was it up there? I've never been there. And he says, oh, we didn't make it. I was like, okay, that's kind of weird. And it's only like a half mile up there. Like, I don't know. He had young kids. I thought didn't bring enough sandwiches or something. Anyway, we part ways. Beautiful day. We push on. It didn't take but 10 steps up that hill to realize things had changed. When I was here in May, the grass was just starting to come up through that dead and down of winter. You know, it was like a beautiful manicured lawn out there. Now it's July. And for any of you in the room who have yet to experience a Kodiak summer, let me fill you in on a little secret. The grass in Kodiak grows to an average height of 17 feet tall. So we're wading through the jungle. Temperatures are high. Humidity is high. Tensions are high. But beautiful day. Sun's high in the sky. We pushed on. About halfway up the hill now, and I heard a sound that I never expected to hear on the day of our engagement. The sound of my beloved partner screaming at the top of her lungs, followed by the hum of 10,000 yellow jackets pouring out of the ground. So I did what any, you know, manly man protector would do. I ran as far and as fast as I could. And I didn't stop until I was out of breath, until I could go no farther. By the time she eventually caught up to me, minutes later, I turned around to assess the damage, and I see that she has sustained 4 stings on her lip, 1 on her cheek, 2 on her arm, and 3 on her thigh. Yeah. If anyone's seen the Will Smith movie Hitch, when he eats the shellfish and his face swells up, it's a pretty good image to keep in your head moving forward. But it's a beautiful day, the sun's high in the sky, we pressed on. Work our way to the top of the hill, just crest over, and there it is. There's the image I've been having in my mind for months. Lakes in the bottom, wildflowers coming down the hill, beavers swimming across, fish jumping. It's perfect. Bail off the backside, get down to the lake, get attacked by mosquitoes, but that's a small point. And shortcut number 2 comes in. First time I came here, I took this long meandering trip around the lake that took hours. But this time, I said, the campsite's right there. It's like 200 yards. I know there's no trail, but like we could just cut across the water. I mean, it's like that deep. We'd be fine. Again, she trusts me implicitly and agrees. So take off our boots, roll up our pants to here, thinking that would work, and start trudging along. And so the way of the mud, the water too starts getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Pretty soon we have our backpacks over our head, chest deep in water, stumbling on our own feet, trying to make it to camp. But beautiful day, sun's high in the sky, we keep going. Eventually we make it to the spot, and this little camping spot full of spruce trees, just it's perfect. I've been dreaming about it for months, ever since I first saw it. I was there once before, I'm sorry. And I sent her down to the lake to lick her wounds and start catching me some fish for dinner. And I get the tent set up, get dinner going, and now's the time. I grab the wine, set the glasses out, pour it, panic for a very nervous 30 seconds, thinking I lost the ring. Eventually find it, stick it in my pocket, make my way down to her. Walk over to her, she's probably reeling in like her 15th fish of the day, and have her put her pole down, hand her both of our wine glasses, and lay out the most beautiful, eloquent words I've ever said that, neither of us remember what I said, but whatever. Took one knee, said those 4 words that I've been dreaming out since, you know, first got into girls back, whatever. And I expected a yes, absolutely. What took you so long? What I got was a mixture of happy tears and a fine Oregon Pinot being poured over my head as I'm down on one knee. I've been laughing to myself this whole day. In my head, I can't say it out loud because she doesn't know what's coming that night. She'd be like, why are you laughing, you crazy person? But in my head, I have just been losing my mind with laughter, knowing that this is how our engagement is going to go. It's full of bee stings, mud, angry beavers, jungles of grass, and I wouldn't have it any other way. It's just how our relationship has been since the start. And eventually, for better or for worse, she said yes. Thank you.
Okay, so I get the honor of introducing Deb Holden Engvall. Please welcome Deb.
I have a very scratchy voice. I've had a cold for the last 2 days, so my apologies. I may have to stop and take a drink of water here every once in a while. So if you're from Massachusetts, it's Worcester. If you're Worcester, you're from Worcester. I have been blessed to be a hospice and palliative care since the beginning for the last 7 years. Our daughter, Anna, is an ICU nurse in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the only level one trauma center in the state. This past year, she had her first experience caring for an organ donor who was declared brain dead. This vibrant, healthy young man in his 20s was involved in a motorcycle accident. It was not his fault. In that instant, his life changed and the life of his family and friends changed forever. The family had to face the decision that no one would ever want to have to make, withdrawing life support. However, that young man gave the gift of life. He chose to be an organ donor. You know that little red heart you have on your driver's license? Years earlier, he made that decision and let his parents know that he chose to be an organ donor. So in that very challenging time in the parents' life, they were given hope and life. Their son gave life to 7 other people that day. And they hung on to that. And those parents knew that their son would live on in the life of 7 other people. And the key thing was is that he let his parents know that that was his decision. Anna and I took the chance to process this. We often talk about it. I have hospice patients. She has ICU patients. And as a mother and daughter, we talk about this and the meaning of life and the meaning of death. I admired the foresight that this young man had to make that decision early in his life to become an organ donor. But this was someone else's family. Fast forward to July of last year. Our family had flown in from Colorado, New Mexico, and Alaska to Massachusetts, near Worcester. And we were at my husband Eric's mother's farmhouse. It had been in the farm for 150 years, and his mom had passed away earlier in the year. And we were all gathered around to have a family memorial service for her. And as we had done so many times, we gathered around the kitchen table in the old farmhouse and shared stories. We caught up with each other's lives. And in that moment, that morning, our daughter announced to us that she was going through the steps to become a live liver donor. As a mom, I tried to remain calm, cool, and collected. The brother of one of her best friends needed a liver transplant. Raul was 27, a nursing student, otherwise healthy young person, active in his community. And he sought out to have to see if any family members could be a donor for him, but there were no matches. Our daughter is O negative, so she's a universal blood donor. And she thought to herself, what if this was my brother and I couldn't be a match? I would hope somebody would step forward. So I tried to remain calm, cool, collected. But in my mind, panic and pride were racing through my mind. I was thinking, what on earth are you doing? You're a healthy young woman. Are you crazy? How long is the surgery? What's involved? Everything was racing through my mind. And then I thought about Raul's mother and sister, which we know our families have eaten together and been together. And I thought, oh my word, this is hope for their son. This is hope that their brother and sister, that their son and their brother can live. So I also thought, wait a minute, you have 2 kidneys and only 1 liver. Don't you need your liver? I know there's some healthcare people out there, but this is like the basic version of what a liver does. So there's a right lobe and a left lobe. And in a healthy liver, it can be resected. What happens is when the donor and the recipient, they go into surgery on the very same day in side-by-side operating rooms. And the doctors will take and resect 1 lobe out of the donor. And in another room, the team is taking out the old liver and waiting for the new liver to come in and connect them all up, connect the plumbing up. So a healthy liver within 1 year will grow back to its original size in both of both people. So at this point, our families are going to be connected. In August, I went with Anna For better or for worse, our family was in this journey together. I went with her through 2 days of testing and probing and interviews to see if she would be a good match. In September, we found out that she was a perfect match for Raul, and then surgery was scheduled for October. Phew. This was now my family we were talking about. This was our daughter who was going to be going under the surgery, and it's a pretty involved surgery. Yet I saw the hope in Raul's mother's eyes and his sister's eyes when they knew that she was a match and this was going to work out for them. There were still possibilities of things not going right, but still, it looked good. However, the doctors were very frank with us when I was sitting there with the meetings. They said, Anna, do you have advanced health care directives? Yes, since I've been 18, my mother made sure I had them. Anna, if there's complications during Raul's surgery, we've already taken out a portion of your liver and we're getting ready to go put it in Raul. If that can't happen, are you willing for your liver to go to someone else? Anna, if there's complications during your surgery, are you willing to donate your other organs? These are pretty tough questions. We talked about it a lot. I'm Anna's health care directive, her power of attorney. And we talk about this all the time. Actually, all three of our kids, they're all in their 20s and they all have advanced health care directives. So, the day of surgery comes, 5:30 in the morning. Team Anna and Team Raul are all there. The medical team puts the two of them side by side in there on the tables that they'll be wheeled back to the operating room. There we are, just with them and knowing that our families will be connected for better or for worse, whatever happens. And as they're wheeled off, we knew the rest of this was in God's hands. I'll be honest, it was the longest day of my life, waiting for the end of the to hear the news when they both came out of surgery. I'm thankful to say that we were blessed that both of them came through surgery with flying colors, and they've been going through a three-month recovery period. Anna went back to work in the ICU in January, and she has a much greater appreciation of what it's like being on the patient side of the bed than being on the nursing side of bed. Raul had to take a medical leave of absence from nursing school, and I'm also happy to say he'll be starting back to nursing school in May. So it is a success story. We're very thankful for the prayers and love support of all of our family and friends. In closing, I want to encourage you all to consider doing two things. One, consider giving life. Consider getting that little red heart on your driver's license and becoming an organ donor. Also, whatever your age, 18 or older, please consider having your advanced health care directives written out and talk to your family about your wishes. In doing so, you'll be giving your family the greatest gift of comfort, peace, and love in a very challenging time. It'll all be for the better.
Brody Blackburn is a singer-songwriter from Seattle.
So I actually am going to be getting an Alaska driver's license very soon, and I checked the box to be an organ donor. So. So my story starts in 2016, where I, boy meets girl in Seattle on Halloween night. She was an X-Men character by the name of Psylocke, and I was Peter Parker. I was cute. I looked real cute. It was either that story or we met on a dating app called Bumble. I'm still not quite sure what story we're going with. Depends on what friend you ask. You're going to get a different variation. And this has been kind of like the precursor to our relationship from the very start. We have our own little secrets that we keep to ourselves, and nobody really knows the full story of a lot of it. So a year later, a little over a year later after we met, I decide I want to write a song for this girl. She's pretty cool. And the second verse goes, okay, I admit, I'm no Brad Pitt, but I can write a song where all the right words fit, like I love you. And the last verse goes, last verse, the moment of truth, and twice in one song, I guess, I love you. Heart beating tremendously when I ask the question, will you marry me? And she says yes, which is better than if she had said no, I think. So So I knew the risks of proposing to a woman in the Coast Guard. Like, for instance, you might have to move to Kodiak. So here we are. Lucky me is right. A month after the proposal, we decide we're going to go get married at the courthouse. Because when you're in the military, you get a little pay bump for being married. So sign, sealed, delivered, I'm yours. And just like that, we're married. And this is another one of those little secrets that most of our friends didn't really know about. But of course, we wanted to have our cake and eat it too, so we had a real wedding. Fast forward to June 15th, 2019. Most of our friends still don't know to this day that we were married before then. So, success. So here's where things start to get a little bit worse. So a month after we get married, my wife, Allie, gets diagnosed with hyperparathyroidism. And if you guys know what that is, awesome. Cool. I don't know what it is. I'm not a doctor. But I know that she had three tumors in her neck, which if I know anything about tumors, it's not good to have them in your body. So anyway, we decided we're going to get through this. She's got orders to come to Kodiak. We're going to do this. If she's got to go back to Seattle and get things taken care of, then she can. She can see a specialist, get the surgery, whatever. So we hop into the car. We road trip from Seattle to Kodiak. We get here in August of 2019. That wasn't that long ago. And I couldn't stay. I had to go back to Seattle to get things sorted out with my job and make sure I actually had a job. I still do, which is great. Yeah, I work from home. It's awesome. They must like me. So it was September of 2019, the end of September, when things started to get dark around here. I walked through the door, and I hadn't seen her in a month and a half almost, and she grabs me by the hand, and she brings me into the house, sets me down, and she gives me a gift. So I take this little gift, and I slowly start unwrapping it, and it's the tiniest little t-shirt that says, Daddy's Hiking Buddy. So she's due in April, so... Yeah. I'm going to be a dad in April. On the exterior, we're so excited, right? We're like, yeah, you're going to be mom, I'm going to be dad. This is great. This is the next chapter. On the inside, I'm like, this isn't what we planned at all. Not at all. We wanted to wait years before this. And how does this hyperparathyroidism affect this pregnancy? And wait, you've been pregnant for how long and you haven't told me about this until now? How many Bloody Marys did you have on that road trip? This isn't good. But more importantly, how does this hyperparathyroidism affect the pregnancy? Well, we found out that while it is extremely rare to have this scenario, it's not so rare that doctors don't know what they're doing and they can't fix the problem, right? So we found that if she had surgery between weeks 15 and 17 of the pregnancy and the surgeon went really fast to get it done in time, all they have to do is monitor the baby's heartbeat before and after the surgery, and all should be well. So that's exactly what she did. She went to Seattle, and her mother flew from Montana to be with her in Seattle, and she left me in Kodiak with the two dogs and two cats that we live with. I'm babysitting, and I'm sitting there by myself. And in situations like these where I'm stressed out and anxious and nervous, and I tend to write things. It's cathartic. That's how I deal with stuff. And I had the thought, what if I never met you at all? You guys ever have that thought about your significant other? What if I never met you at all? Now, that could go both ways, right? Like, things would be a lot better if I hadn't met so-and-so, right? Well, it wasn't how it was for me. It was more like this. What if I never met you at all? Never said hello. Never held you through the cold. You'd still be the dream of a girl lying on the cold side of my bed, dancing through the shadows in my room, dancing through the thoughts inside my head. And on paper planes and checklists, you flew high while you held my hand, and we stuck together like the pages in a storybook plan. Now let's go back to the moment that we locked minds in a one-life stand and ride together on the back of a bumblebee. Do you remember when we lied to all of our friends to make our secrets our own? Those little white secrets have grown into warming up the right side of my bed, dancing through the shadows in my room and flirting with the thoughts inside my head. And on paper planes and checklists, you flew high while you held my hand, and we stuck together like the pages in a storybook plan. Now let's go back to that moment that we locked minds in a one-life stand and ride together on the back of a bumblebee. And soon we'll have a child to hold, to teach about the bad and the good, to teach us all the things we'd forgotten and lead us through the misunderstood. And on paper planes and checklists, you'll fly high while you hold our hands, and we'll stick together like the pages in a storybook plan. Now let's go back to the moment that we locked minds in a one-life stand and ride together on the back of a bumblebee. What if I never met you at all, or lied to all of your friends to make our secrets our own?
Thank you. Thanks. So, thank you guys. So right after I wrote that song, I get a call from my mother-in-law saying the surgery went better than they could have ever expected, and they removed the tumors. They were non-cancerous, which is great. And most importantly, the baby's heart is still beating. And that was much better. Huge sense of relief. And I hope that the only thing that gets worse with us and our relationship moving forward is the fact that, like, I'm probably going to get shorter with age. Or my eyesight or my cholesterol or something. Anyway, thank you guys. My name's Brody Blackburn.
Our next storyteller is Diane Million. Please welcome to the stage, Diane.
I'm not used to talking to this many people at one time. I work at the brewery, and I talk to a couple people at a time here and there, and I love what I do. But I'm here to tell you, for better or for worse, this is my story. This is my actual life, and this is really what happened. Once upon a time, I was 22 and got married to someone else, and I didn't realize it until well into it that I was in a really unhealthy relationship. It was unhealthy for me. It was unhealthy for my kids. And I needed to make a change. I needed to leave that relationship, and I worked for a medical company, which I loved. I was regulatory affairs, QA person, six figures, had, like, that stuff was great. But at home, it was not great. It was scary at times. And I went in and asked the HR person with my boss in the room, if I quit my job, what can you tell anyone that calls who says, why is my wife, daughter, whatever, not working there anymore? And they say, well, all we can say is she's no longer employed here. They don't give a reason. So I said, I quit. And I did. I quit. I went and I took a job. I went to a real estate class. I took a job as a realtor working for an amazing broker. I went and took a job at Krabby Dick's, which is an amazing restaurant on the water in Delaware City, Delaware, where we sold crab balls and semen sauce. My bosses were amazing. They were two guys that I just absolutely adored. They gave me a place to stay whenever I needed one. They understood the situation I was in. They were the first people I told about the situation I was in. So I was able to somehow save $5,000 in a frozen bag of peas in our freezer. My ex-husband hated peas. So I just, whatever I could, I stuck it in there. So at one point, my ex's family was sitting down, and I felt like it was that time. I made a statement that I didn't think our relationship was going to last. And they said the scariest thing I've ever heard in my entire 46 years of life. If you leave, we'll keep the kids. You're not going to get them. And that's a scary thing, and I know that sounds really awful, but it made me think. And, I mean, $5,000 is a lot of money, but that's not more than what they had. They had millions. So my broker's wife, Debbie, was an amazing human. She gave me amazing advice, and she's the first person I told everything to. I just emptied my soul to her. I told her whatever was going on in my life. And she said to me, why don't you come to church? Well, no offense to anyone, but I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I asked a lot of questions like, if God says you'll be rewarded in heaven, why wouldn't the devil, for doing his work here on earth, be like, hey, welcome to the bonfire, beer's a little warm? You know, I couldn't understand. And I asked horrible questions that they still to this day have not answered. So I was extremely not happy about going to church. But she pestered and she pestered and she pestered and she was like, what's the worst that's going to happen? You just come to church. So I did. On a Sunday morning, she came by and picked me up because she was afraid I wouldn't go myself. And she took me to a church that was not Roman Catholic because she knew about the 12 years. And I don't know, I looked at her and I just said, well, what do I do now? She said, just ask. Ask for what you need. So out loud, so she heard me, I got down on my knees in the pew and I said, if you just give me $1 million, I will get out of here. I never have to see them and the threats that they put on me and the threats of taking my children and the physical threats and everything else. I said, and I'll go away. And I'll go far away. Fast forward, literally 1 week later, my bosses, who I adored, called me and asked me to fill in a waitressing shift at Krabby Dick's. It's Sunday. I don't want to go to work, but my kids, my oldest two, they had a sleepover at a friend's house in the neighborhood, and I thought, oh, it's okay. They're covered. I called their mom, Michelle. She was like, yeah, I got them. And I took the shift. 2 or 3 hours into the shift, a whole bunch of uniform guys walked in. My bosses looked out the window of the kitchen. They're like, oh, there's uniforms here. We should put D on it and let her take care of them. Well, my boaties, all my boat guys that were out there, did not like the idea that the United States Coast Guard had just showed up because these guys had a table full of booze. And they knew if they tried to leave on their boats, the Coast Guard was going to try and board them. And this guy at the Coast Guard table kept asking me for my number. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. I'm old enough to be your big sister. And he kept pestering, and he had others at the table pester. And I was like, fine, you know what? I got a car for sale in the parking lot. My cell phone number's on it. And there went the table. Later that night, I got a text message from Jet that said, hey, I was that guy with the mustache and the sunglasses, Coast Guard. I'd really like to take you out. And he did. So mind you, in church, I sat down and I asked, dear God, please give me $1 million. I don't know if you paid attention to who they introduced, but after an amazing breakfast Monday morning, very amazing dates the next couple of months, the moral of my story is, be very careful what you ask for in church, because I asked God for $1 million and I never specified in cash. I married Jet Mitchell Million, and I also have Chase Amber Million, and the older two daughters, Caitlin and Alexis, go by Million, even though it's not legal. So I have a household of millions. But I still struggle to pay the bills. And I just want to say thank you for letting me tell this story. And I love you, for better or for worse.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life.